We will be hitting chapters 6 and 7. Chapter 6 and 7 today, after getting to the first 5, we are on the cusp of the real adventure opening up. So, just to remind us of what's happened, Lucy has stumbled her way into this magical realm, and she did so through the wardrobe. Nobody else believes her because they can't make it happen. Edmund, on another time in, follows her secretly, and they get separated, so she doesn't know that he's there, and he can't find her, so he finds somebody else instead. Who does he find?
The witch.
We have this enchanted Turkish delight, and she is extremely interested to find out that there are 4 of them all together.
She wants to meet them.
She wants to meet them, and she wants Edmund to bring them into Narnia and to do what with them?
Bring them to her castle.
And she even gives them directions and the 2 little hills, and I want you to do it. But keep it a surprise. Don't tell them what you're doing. Why?
Because she wants to destroy it, because she thinks there are the 4 that are...
We don't know that yet.
Well, they alluded to it in the earlier chapters.
There's nothing we know yet.
We don't know
about four being an interesting number for some reason.
Yeah.
She's showing interest, but we don't know what that's connected to yet.
Okay.
But we do know that rather than just obliterate Edmund immediately, which it looked like she was about to do, she has changed her mind. She became very, very friendly towards Edmund, but in a calculating way. And now she wants all 4 of them at once to come to her house. So Edmund goes back through the wardrobe where, Lucy knows that he's done this. And what's Edmund's greatest betrayal to date?
He doesn't back her up.
He doesn't back her up. Lucy's so excited that now they share this together and they can all go. And Edmund throws her under the bus.
Yeah.
Oh, we were just playing and pretending. And Lucy is just despondent. So, they're afraid now that it's been days, and she cannot let this loose. She is a fundamentally honest little girl and cannot bring herself to lie and say it's not true. And Edmund, who has no problem lying at all, they're starting to get worried. She is not dropping this story, and she's not calming down. So what do they do? They need to speak to the professor because they're worried, do we have to,
go home?
Are we going to be sent away? Do we need to call a doctor? Is she crazy? What is this? And with the professor's insistence on logic, he suggests to them that if they examine the evidence, which of the 2 stories should they give more credence to, based on which of the people is more trustworthy? Okay? They've never known Lucy to lie, ever. Edmund? Dirty liar all the time. They assume, if she's telling the story, she's either lying to us, which doesn't seem to make sense, well, then she must be crazy. They can only come up with 2 alternatives. The professor, does he think that she's crazy?
No.
Why not?
No. He thinks she's challenging her.
Why does the professor think that she's crazy?
Is it because he already knows his house has mysteries?
Well, he knows that there's mysteries there, but just based on observation, she has nothing pointing towards craziness. She seems like the exact same little girl she's always been, truthful and honest and everything else. What's standing in their way of accepting it is not the fact that she might be crazy, it's that they don't believe that her story could possibly be true. But if you allow that possibility, if you give it 3 possibilities instead of 2, the kids can only see 2. They see lying and they see crazy. And the professor says, well, you have not even considered the fact she might be telling you the truth. So, now that we have 3 possibilities, lying, crazy, or telling the truth, Which one seems the most plausible? Which one seems the most likely? Which one fits the evidence? Which one is the logical conclusion? And the logical conclusion is, no matter how unbelievable it sounds, that Lucy is actually telling the truth. And what other C.S. Lewis teaching did I connect that to? Remember from last week? The three L's. Liar, lunatic, or Lord. About the claims of Jesus within the Gospels to counter people saying, nah, you know, I don't believe in the whole Jesus thing, but I like him as a good moral teacher. And C.S. Lewis says, well, if you take Jesus at his word through the Gospels, his good morals are actually pretty bad. Because he says all this stuff that should be pretty disturbing about being able to forgive sins, about following him, about how his flesh is food, and all the difficult things like, you know, I'm not going to bring peace, but bring a sword, and that kind of stuff. So he is either a malicious, terrible, conniving liar, or he is an absolute crazy person, or he is precisely who he says he is, and he is the Lord. So this logical separation of the possibilities, liar, lunatic, or Lord, within the nature of Jesus, he is applying and teaching through this interaction with the professor and the children about the story of Lucy and Narnia. So Peter and Susan, the two oldest, still don't know what to make of it. They feel a little chastened. Frankly, I think they're just confused by what the professor has said. But they kind of let things go after that, and now they are trapped as the mean-spirited housekeeper is leading another historical tour, and they know that if they get in the way, they're going to get in trouble.
So they went in the wardrobe.
Except they didn't shut the door because they know no sensible person would do that.
Yeah.
Which leads us now into chapter 6. So, here we are in chapter 6, and it's entitled Into the Forest, which leads us to believe that, what?
They're
going to go through the wardrobe into the forest. And they do.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Did their level of belief have to come to the level where the professor gets them to believe a possibility of truth have to come before they can go through the wardrobe?
No idea. Because remember that Lucy's experience was out of nowhere. There was no context to it. She didn't think she was exploring anything. She just liked wardrobes and she liked furs, and it was just one of those things. Edmund certainly doesn't believe. He sees her go into the wardrobe and he wants to follow to tease her. So I don't know why it doesn't work for the kids sometimes, and it doesn't work other times. But regardless, it worked now. Now, interestingly enough, right before we get into this, the very end of chapter 5, remember that they keep trying to avoid the tour group, but it seems like everywhere they go, the tour group is right about to come around the corner. As almost as though they were being chased towards the one room they didn't want to go to. You know, Peter and Susan, they probably just want to forget all about this and avoid that room altogether because it's been nothing but trouble. But now they are forced and they all hop in and surprise, surprise.
But, while I'm reading this, I can't help but do it's like an allegory of our own journeys towards things that are beyond us, our spiritual journey. I mean, we're forced sometimes, led sometimes, and then sometimes, and things you can't really believe or you can't really get together.
Well, there's that, you know, when C.S. Lewis relates his conversion story, and Surprised by Joy, a very famous passage, and he talks about that feeling of being hunted, a sense of being hunted. that he did not want to be a believer. He had been very comfortable in his atheism for a long time, and he felt a desperate desire to escape. But it's like the hunter was pursuing him and getting closer all the time. And you read this little passage, and there's almost this sense of anxiety, like all of my avenues of exit are being stopped, and I'm getting closed in. I've gotten cornered. And now, and he talks about when it actually happens, he just has to kind of give up. Like, that God was God, and that's all there was to it. And there's another real beautiful passage where he says, you can kind of understand the prodigal son story, where the son kind of comes back in humility and is accepted by the father in joy. He said, but who can love a prodigal? He describes himself as, you know, acting like a chained animal, with their eyes darting side to side, hoping for any avenue of escape. Because that's kind of how he felt. Like, he would do anything to make this not true, but eventually he had to acknowledge the fact that God was real. And this was true.
But he does that with all of us, too.
I forget who wrote it, but a poem that likens God to the Hound of Heaven.
Yeah. Oh, that's, yes. Who
chases us down.
Yeah.
Even though not only do we wander astray, sometimes we run away. So they have been chased into Narnia, where they never would have gone, but they've had no escape, and now they are there. And so what happens is it first starts to dawn on them about what's happened.
They get wet. They're leaning against something that's sticky.
Yeah. So again, you get this cool kind of like this little sensory transition between, you know, bumbling and stumbling into a wardrobe and a bunch of them together till all of a sudden, and there's like, and there's the scratchiness of trees and the wetness of snow. And
it's cold.
And it's cold.
Yeah.
And they think maybe they better put some coats on.
Right.
So, right place.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of cute, like, oh, but these aren't our coats.
No.
And how do they solve that problem?
You won't get bagged for taking something but not out of the house.
Well, it's never leaving the wardrobe.
Yeah.
It's not that we're stealing it, we're never leaving the wardrobe. I mean, it's a pretty good logical conclusion.
Yes. Yeah.
So how do they deal with the fact that they haven't believed Lucy?
They apologize.
So now Peter and Lucy basically apologize. Peter and Susan apologize to Lucy quite frankly.
Yes.
And she just accepts it readily and happily.
Yeah.
She seems to be just happy as a clam that this has all worked out. Now, how does Edmund, early on, Edmund's kind of quiet about this, and nothing happens. But Edmund somehow gives the game away that he's been here before. What happens?
Directs them before that he is.
Yeah, that
he has some knowledge, like, if we're going to go to the lamppost, shouldn't we kind of be veering off to the side a little bit?
Yeah.
And suddenly, you have been here before, you dirty liar.
Yeah.
You dirty, dirty liar.
Peter could not stand
And later on he says, I'll pay all of you this, you better.
When they talk about the coats, they put them on. And it says they look like
royal
robes. That might be giving us a clue as to what's going to be coming in the future.
Sure. There are some of the old illustrations, I think maybe in, they might have been first edition illustrations, but I've seen them in books later on in that. And there's one that I'm thinking of in particular where the kids are, this is early on, they're together and they're walking, and they're wearing these fur coats, which are probably, they're probably relatively large coats, you know, for an adult. But on those kids, I mean, they go down basically to the ground. And it does have, you know, a little bit of that, you know, kind of royal feel to it.
What a nasty little boy. I'll pay you what I'll pay this. You have self-satisfying friends.
Now, who does he say that to?
To himself.
To himself. He doesn't have the guts to say it out loud.
He said it to himself.
But inside, he's like, I'm gonna fix your little red
bag.
I'm gonna get back all of you. What does he think is gonna happen?
He's gonna be king.
King is gonna be the king.
He's gonna be the king.
And the others are gonna be his subjects.
And the others will be his subjects. And once he is in power, then he can really
he'll give it to them.
Give it to them good. That's right.
Sure enough.
Alright, so all these kids are apparently up for an adventure, and Peter, who, he's still young. Peter is most likely maybe 12-ish is the guess. His deference is to say, well, who should be in charge? I think it ought to be
Lucy.
We gave you a hard time and we didn't believe you. Not a lot of 12-year-old boys will do that.
No.
But he seems like he's a good older brother. Yeah. And he seems to have a sense of integrity about him to say, you know, you've earned it.
Yeah.
You tell us where to go. And what's
her
idea?
She was there.
And she'd been there before.
Mm-hmm. So she knew more than they did. And certainly more than Edmund was letting on.
She wants to go see
Mr.
Thomas. Yeah, so she says, let's go see Mr. Thomas the Fawn. He's this nice fawn. It's going to be great. And so, you know, she basically knows how to get there. She's been there at least a couple of times.
Yeah.
And had, you know, these little chats with her.
Yeah.
So
sardines on crackers.
Toast. So, all right. So they make it over to Mr. Tumnus's house, and what do they find?
A wreck.
Everything is horrible. The picture of his father has been smashed.
It's been ransacked.
Yeah.
He is not there.
He's not there.
It's eerie. It's scary. Now, they were maybe in the mood for a little adventure. You know, hey, this has been fun, and it's amazing and wondrous and snowy wood and a nice fawn. But all of a sudden, the cold reality has slapped them in the face. We don't know anything about this world, and we might have just stepped in a whole lot of trouble.
And then there was a note.
And what's the note say?
Hammered to the floor. The former occupant of these premises, the Fawn Tumnus, is under arrest and awaiting his trial on a charge of high treason.
High treason.
Against her Imperial Majesty. Now, if you know all this, Jagus.
Yes, Jagus.
Queen of Nyria, whatever the rest
of Shadowland of Pierre Paravel, Empress Alone Islands, etc. And of also comforting her, said Majesty's enemies, harboring spies.
Fraternizing
with humans.
She has quite a title.
Yes. Indeed.
She thinks a lot of her.
Captain of the Secret.
That's right. So, long live the Queen! Yeah, you have to sign that off to make sure it's official at the end. Okay, so Tumnus has been arrested.
Yeah.
And he has been arrested for high treason. What is the high treason he is alleged to have committed?
Fraternizing with the
humans. Which means what?
He was supposed to bring Lucy to the
queen.
And
he
didn't do what
he
was supposed to do.
Right. So this fraternizing with a human, he had lunch with Lucy.
Yeah.
That's why he's under arrest.
And he helped her back home.
He helped her back home. He's met with her multiple times. He has not turned her in.
Yes.
That's the fraternization. That is the high treason.
Yeah.
Is that he did not kidnap Lucy when he had the chance. Yeah.
And Edmund was the one to give it away.
And Edmund was the one. Now, for all we know, Tumnus and Lucy's time together was kept a perfect secret.
Mm-hmm.
But when Edmund is talking to the queen, he mentions a fawn.
Yeah.
And that his sister has been here already. So who drops the dime on Tumnus? Probably Edmund.
Yeah.
Edmund.
So another.
A nasty little piece of work that boy is. All right. So, they're trying to figure out who the queen is, and Lucy educates them.
Mm-hmm. She's the one that's made it winter here all the time.
That's
yeah,
right. So, Tumnus has told her about the White Witch,
mm-hmm.
and that Narnia used to be a place of springtime and
flowers,
holidays and dancing and singing and all this kind of stuff. But for 100 years now, the white witch has been in power, has dominated everyone and everything. And as a part of that, all the springtime is gone, all the happiness and all the singing, and it is always winter, and it is never Christmas. And again, it is, that's, for a kid, that's about as lonely and bereft as you can get. All right, so it's starting to sink into the kids, and Susan and Peter in particular, the older ones, are starting to think, what have we gotten into? We don't know this place at all. I'm a little bit reminded of, you know, you might be out on just kind of a nice drive or whatever, and you take some turns just because you're out sightseeing, or you've got nothing to do, and it's just for fun. And you're, oh, this is kind of nice, and this is kind of interesting. And then you come across something like, you know, you hear a shot, or you hear somebody yelling and screaming, or something like, maybe I shouldn't stick around.
Oh, you see a house with the, I remember this on the drive we did one Sunday, a house with the door open, and there were plates with food in them on the table that we could see, and this big cobweb from the wall to the open door.
Oh, that's crazy.
We told my father to get out of there.
Yeah, that's crazy. Time to go.
That sounds like Halloween.
So, so what's the kids kind of have a little debate about what to do next. What are their options?
Go home.
Go home. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, I don't know what we're into, but this is not good. Okay. Who wants to rescue Thomas?
Lucy.
Lucy. Now, Lucy is his friend.
Yeah.
And so that makes sense. But why else? Why else is
she feels guilty?
It's not really her fault, but she does feel responsible. Whose fault is it really?
Edmund.
But Lucy, she, you know, if it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And him being my friend, he would not have been, he wouldn't be in trouble like this.
Yeah.
We need to do something.
Well, he doesn't.
But when he doesn't do anything, he doesn't do anything.
Well,
I
don't want to
fight.
I wonder if the wanting to eat was because that was how he was going to lure them to.
He was trying to get more stuff.
I mean, interestingly enough,
Turkish
delight. You know, Edmund is probably the most sensible in his comment, well, what could we do? You know, they're four children in the middle of a world they don't understand at all.
Yeah, but it's independent.
Haven't
got anything.
But there's kind of this practical thing of, we're in the woods, in the snow, and we're hungry. We know nothing and no one. And Edmund almost kind of looks like the voice of reason here.
Yeah.
But we know better.
And Peter tells him to shut up.
I think Peter's had enough of Edmund right now.
Brotherly love.
So what do they decide to do?
Keep going.
They all feel it.
Okay, they decide we ought to help them, we don't know how, and then they see a robin. And the robin,
yeah.
How does the robin play into this?
He shows them the way
to find somebody else. Now, what was so interesting or unusual about this robin? Why would they be willing to follow a robin?
It kept looking.
This robin seems to understand, though.
Yeah.
Robin doesn't say anything, but he looks almost as though he could.
Yeah.
And so he kind of hops a few feet away so they can still see him, and they follow, and then he hops, and they follow, and he hops, and they follow. And so after about a half an hour, he gets them into a clearing, and he's gone.
Yeah.
So then what happens?
And then they beat them.
Peter sees this form.
There's something moving.
Yeah.
There's maybe this moment of suspense. Oh my gosh, what is it? What's going to happen next?
He's hiding.
And then they see what?
A beaver.
And how, why is this beaver so unusual?
Because he's motioning to them.
Yeah.
This beaver motions, follow me, and he goes, putting his paw up against his mouth like hush.
Yeah.
You ever seen a beaver do that?
No.
Just a second. There was something I thought was funny. Neat. They've been whispering back and forth, and they and Edmund whispered to Peter that they were perhaps lost. At the end of the last chapter, they decide. I thought these kids are realizing that they were at the end of the last chapter.
Right. And then half an hour of walking who knows where, and now they finally... all right, so... so we've now moved into the next chapter. I'd forgotten that. The beaver's actually... We don't meet him until chapter 7. So here in chapter 7, and there's this odd behavior, again, amazing, remarkable... mysterious behavior from an animal, but what do?
They follow him.
He
said he had food.
Well, he hasn't said anything yet.
No.
They're still trying to decide what to do.
They're
trying to decide what to do, and all the kids have a little response, and Edmund once again is like, well, how do we know?
This
beaver is trustworthy.
Yeah. About everything.
Yeah. Well, at this point, what do you have to lose? So the beaver is doing it again. Come on. And they finally follow him kind of around the corner, and the beaver speaks. Beavers in our world do not speak. This one has now... has now said further in, come further in, right in here, we are not safe in the open. And, you know, maybe they just don't know what to do with a talking beaver other than listen and obey him. So off they go, and what does he ask them?
If they were the sons of Adam.
Are you the sons of Adam and the daughters of Eve? Anyone have it open and can see Peter's response?
Yeah, or some of
we're
them.
Some of them.
Some of them. Not all of them.
Yeah. Are you the humans? Well,
yeah,
but there's like, you know, a billion more back to the wardrobe. But yes, you know, yeah, we're the humans, and but the beaver is still very concerned about this not being a safe place. What's not safe about it?
Some of the trees.
Remember, even Tumnus said that in the very beginning.
Yeah.
When he was leading Lucy back home instead of kidnapping her, he said, be careful, even some of the trees are on her side. So this whole world is enchanted, and you don't know what is alive and what isn't, and what is good and what is bad.
Well, that's it.
But I mean, you don't typically worry that the trees are going to overhear you in our world. But this one, all of a sudden, they're thinking, I don't know what to make of this, but I do know that this is strange.
But Edmund isn't sure.
So what finally pushes them over the edge to trust the beaver?
Not yet.
He hasn't opened.
He's got something. What does he have?
He has a handkerchief.
Lucy's handkerchief. Yeah. So this is now taking us all the way back to her first time, where Tumnus confesses what happens, and he starts crying until there's a pool of tears on the ground, and Lucy gives a handkerchief. So this has become one of Tumnus's prized possessions of his friendship. He kept it. Joe, no, you keep that. and so the beaver has it. So if the beaver has it, what does that mean about the relationship between the beaver and Tumnus? They've got to know each other. And so suddenly that's enough to break the ice.
Yeah.
And so they follow him, and they eventually make it to his house. And so, you know, there's, you know, kind of a neat little thing. Oh, that's true. We need to get to something before we get to the house. This is maybe the most significant part of these chapters that we're reading, is that that just seeing the token seemed to kind of change everything. Like, okay, now we're on board.
Yeah.
We're on board. And so the beaver explains, what about Mr. Tumnus?
Well,
he's
been captured by the...
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. But before he got arrested, what happened?
Oh, if anything happened to him, I must meet you here.
Yes.
And
so
take you on to...
So he got wind that the witch was coming. So he made a contingency plan with the beavers, who he obviously must trust. And that's where the handkerchief comes in.
Oh yeah.
And this, now the beaver's been entrusted with a job by Tumnus, is to take them somewhere. And it's not just his house.
Oh, they say the Aslan is on
the move. Aslan is on the move. Perhaps he has already landed.
Yeah.
Now, this paragraph that happens after that, if you got your book with you, I think you need to, we all need to be looking at it.
It's on
867.
So I'm going to actually read this, because I think this is worth not just pondering, but I just want it to kind of wash over us for a second. A not very curious thing happened. None of the children knew who Aslan was any more than you do. But the moment the beaver had spoken these words, everyone felt quite different. Perhaps it sometimes happened to you in a dream that someone says something which you don't understand, but in the dream it feels as if it had some enormous meaning, either a terrifying one which turns the whole dream into a nightmare, or else a lovely meaning, too lovely to put into words, which makes the dream so beautiful that you remembered all your life, and are always wishing you could get into that dream again. It was like that now. At the name of Aslan, each one of the children felt something jump inside. Edmund felt a sensation of mysterious horror.
No wonder.
Peter felt suddenly brave and adventurous. Susan felt as if some delicious smell or some delightful strain of music had just floated by her. And Lucy got the feeling you have when you wake up in the morning and realize it is the beginning of the holidays or the beginning of summer. He simply speaks the name of Aslan, and they don't even know what it means. But something stirs inside of them. Something that hits them all differently. And it seems to hit them almost at their character. You know, Edmund feels fear, and Peter feels bravery, and Susan feels something that sweet and wonderful, and Lucy feels something beautifully exciting, and the name, just the name.
It's like the
just
name of
the
Jesus.
Jesus, there's just something about that name. Master, Savior, Jesus, like the fragrance after the rain. Do you know that one?
Yeah,
I've heard it.
Jesus, 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 let all heaven and earth proclaim. Kings and kingdoms shall all pass away, but there's something about that name. It's an old Gaither song.
Yeah.
But that, you know, kings and kings shall all pass away, but there's something about that name, like the fragrance after the rain, some indescribable sensation or feeling, but just the very name, Yeshua, God saves, just something about the identity of Christ that happens when you simply say his name. Saying his name which, depending on the person, becomes a prayer or a curse. Depending on the person, is either something that fills them with peace or upsets them and makes them angry. There are few words that can be spoken to a person that will evoke more from them, just on a deeply emotional, almost a reflexive sense. I can't think of a single other word as one word that you could get that many different reactions, the deep felt reactions from more people. You say the name of Jesus to someone, and some people will be upset. You say the name of Jesus to someone, and some people will be delighted. You say the name of Jesus to someone, and it gets a reaction. And think of all the ways that it's used. Again, from a prayer to a swear word. And so, at the name of Aslan, even though they have no idea what it means or who he is, something stirs deep inside of each of the children. Something that's different. Something that's powerful. And we will meet Aslan, and he is this figure of Christ for this world, for this universe that they find themselves in. But this paragraph, I think, is just so important, and it's so beautiful that the introduction to Aslan is simply just a name that already you can tell means everything. Now, they say Aslan is on the moon. And what do you think that means?
There must be something on the moon.
He's coming, something's happening. This will be a phrase, and you'll see it more than once.
He must have some power over this universe for them to feel. Yes.
They say he's on the move.
He's coming.
The ancient prayer of the church, Maranatha, come Lord Jesus, that in the midst of the turmoil of this life, the promise of Christ to return and set everything right eternally is this ongoing hope. And to simply say Aslan is on the move is this statement of hope and assurance. Aslan is on the move. It's active. Not just trust in Aslan or believe in Aslan. He's on the move. And if he's on the move, where is he moving?
He's going to be here.
Here. Yeah. He's coming. Aslan is on the move, not away from us. He's coming towards us. Now, I may or may not get my dates right. I want to say this is around 1985 or 1986. So I was like fifth or sixth grade. And Bishop Falwell had retired. And we were in the process of electing the new bishop. And I remember reading the Central Florida Episcopalian, the little newspaper that came back, even back in the 80s, and they had interviews with the candidates. And I don't remember five or six of them or whatever. And I read through them, I don't know these people. And one of them, the tone was just different. You got a feeling from the writing that there was excitement and there was adventure and there was joy. A lot of the other candidates, they made theological points or they talked about, potential plans in the future. And one of them, it was almost like you could hear drum beats and hoofs racing, like this was going, Christ was calling us on a grand adventure kind of thing. Let's go. And it made the others seem kind of flat in comparison. And even as a kid, I could pick up that there was something different about this candidate. And he finished, his essay with Aslan is on the move. And I stood up and I said, that's my God. And we elected John Howe, the man who wrote that essay, and he served our diocese for 26 years. So, I mean, I still think, whenever I think Aslan's on, I mean, I remember him writing that. And just like, yes, yes. So, anyway, that's a great, great, great paragraph. But, so back into the story, with all these sensations, Susan, Lucy wants to know what's going on with Mr. Tumnus, and he's like, oh, we'll get to that. So, they still need to be in a safe spot. And so he has to lead them to, you know, through the trees and the forest and everywhere else. And he's still paying a rear. And we finally make it into this beaver lodge. And let's compare and contrast for a second the beaver lodge with Mr. Tumnus's home. How are they alike and how are they different?
Well, they didn't have a lot of books, and there weren't any pictures on the wall.
That's right.
It was clean.
He's built on a dam.
Mm-hmm.
It's frozen.
Mr. Tumnus, I think his home, both of them are described as comfortable and homey.
Yeah, yeah.
But Mr. Tumnus seems a little, you know, books and pictures and nice little things. Mm-hmm. And this one seems more earthy and it seems more workmanlike. You know, whether it's an issue of economic prosperity, Mr. Tumnus might be a little wealthier, or the fact that, you know, we don't get any sense of what Mr. Tumnus does. He goes shopping and he has parcels and he's got sardines on toast.
Yeah.
But the beavers, very clearly, they work. She sews.
Yeah, she had a Jewish.
He builds dams and fishes and so you get like this kind of common man feel.
He drinks beer.
Mr. Beaver seems just like a guy. You know, he's just a good guy.
Yeah.
He's not fancy. Neither of them are fancy, but they seem to be good. This is a home. This is a hearth. It is warm and it is good.
Yeah.
So there is a. There's an evil passage here that you might not catch or it might not connect in the same way I connected. But they first come into the lodge and they meet Mrs. Beaver, and she's sewing. And so she responds, oh, you've come at last. She said, holding out her wrinkled paws, at last, to think I should ever live to see this day. Why is she so excited?
We're humans.
So we're getting hints that this means something.
The humans have come, so there's so much.
It means something that the witch doesn't like.
Yeah.
And it means something that Mr. Tumnus he's aware of, but it's important, but we're not really sure how. And this is now something that the beavers have longed for. Clearly, there's a sense of amazement, and I can't believe I have lived to see the day.
Simeon.
That is exactly where my mind goes. That is exactly where my mind goes. So remember now, this is in Luke. This is the end of Luke chapter 2. So in Luke chapter 2, we get the birth of Jesus, and we get shepherds abiding, and the angels singing, and all that kind of stuff. But later on, we get the newborn Jesus taken for the appropriate sacrifice of being born, the firstborn male and everything else. And there in the temple are two people, Anna the prophetess
and Simeon.
Simeon, who God has told, you will not die before you see my promised Messiah. We don't know why, we don't know how, but Simeon knows this. And he's there. And Mary and Joseph bring in baby Jesus. And Simeon greets them with what we refer to as the nunc dimittis. Lord, you may now set your servant free to go in peace as you have promised. For these eyes of mine have seen the Savior whom you have prepared for all the world to see. A light to enlighten the nations and the joy of your people Israel. Lord, I may now die in peace because you made a promise and in this baby you have fulfilled it. This is the light of the world. For Mrs. Beaver, this is that moment. But she wasn't promised anything. But there's something so important about having those four children show up. Mrs. Beaver is actually saying, I can't believe I'm alive to see it. So, Mr. Beaver catches them some fish. Now, a little underscore here about the different types of good homes. You know, they're both, Mr. Tumnus and the Beavers, they're described as good places and homey places and places that, you know, you would want to be. Mr. Tumnus has something to offer them. Like, you know, Lucy shows up basically out of nowhere, and he's like, oh, you know, sardines on toast. What does Mr. Beaver need to do? He's got to catch the fish. Yeah. They don't keep a lot on hand, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's some hams hanging and the onions, this sort of seems like someone's, like their pantry, their mm-hmm. larder. You know, this is like homesteaders who they stock up during the summer so they can survive little by little over the winter off the little bits they've been able to preserve. Mm-hmm. But how is this meal?
It's wonderful.
It's rustic. But it's like the best thing.
Yeah.
And of course, nothing tastes so good as when you're hungry. But you even get a little C.S. Lewis in there where he admits that there, in his opinion, there's nothing better than freshwater fish.
That's right.
That had been alive a half an hour ago and came out of the pan half a minute ago.
Yeah.
And if you've ever had that, like real freshness,
it's different.
It is something. So, they have had this simple meal, but now that you know this big marmalade roll is coming. I mean, these kids have been stuffed with some awfully simple food, but it's been very, very good. And now we're kind of, now's the time to, you know, just kind of put your feet up and you have your tea and you have your pipe and you have your whatever. And it starts to snow. Why is it good that it's snowing?
Because no one will come to visit, and it won't leave tracks.
That's right. They've had to walk here in the snow, and so there are tracks. But what's happened is that with new fallen snow, no one will be able to see those footprints. And they won't expect any visitors to surprise them, because who's going to go out in the middle of a snowstorm?
Yeah, right.
So now, we've eaten, we're protected, we're safe. Now it's time to talk business. But we'll have to find that out.
Yes.
Okay. Two chapters. You pushed away,
and drank tea. Finally done with this beer, now's tea time. Okay, so how are we on the two chapters versus three? Do we want to stick with that?
Yeah.
Okay. So we did chapter 6 and 7, so next time we will do 8 and 9. And we will take it from there. Any last thoughts?
If you haven't seen the movie, it really helps. You can picture everything that's
going on. I do think the first movie is quite good.
Where did you people see the movie?
I loved it quite a bit.
I mean, Netflix was children, right? When they were growing up, we watched it.
But
it's on Netflix.
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah, that's an actual name of the movie.
And it is on Netflix.
You probably can get it in the
we can get it on Netflix. My grandchildren, you're too old. They didn't see them.
So,
I didn't see the movies with them.
We're starting to take a turn. All right, the adventure has begun in earnest, and they're now there. No more who's telling the truth and who's crazy and all that kind of stuff. So all the kids are together. They are in this magical world, and an adventure is starting to develop. And hints are being dropped that something important is happening, and these kids have a place in the importance. Not sure what, not sure how. Each of them is struck in a different fashion, but definitely big things are afoot, and we are about to find out more and more what happens next. So I will.
It's a great story.
I'll catch you next time.
Thank you.